KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Protests against immigration raids spread across the country. A Homeland Security official tells us why they believe the Marines and National Guard are needed in Los Angeles. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. France is leading efforts for Western countries to formally recognize a Palestinian state. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. An Israeli official says they might annex part of the occupied West Bank in retaliation. Also, how federal spending cuts are delaying efforts on an HIV vaccine. It is Wednesday, June 11th. On this day in 1963, JFK federalized the Alabama National Guard after Governor George Wallace tried to block two black students from enrolling at the University of Alabama. Wallace and state troopers with him stepped aside. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. An overnight curfew has ended in downtown Los Angeles. The curfew area covers 1 square mile. That's where protesters have been demonstrating against federal immigration raids. NPR's Martin Costi reports the presence of federal troops is making the situation more unpredictable.
The Trump administration says it sent 4,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines to Los Angeles in response to anti-ICE protests, which have led to some violence and looting. LA Mayor Karen Bass says she's not sure why they came.
We just don't know. And I think that's a problem with the administration, because to come in such a massive way and to make the announcements that all of this was going to happen and then not communicate with the local jurisdiction as to when, what, how, why, is really problematic.
The administration says it had to send in troops, despite the opposition and even a lawsuit by the state, because it says local police weren't doing enough to protect ICE agents enforcing immigration laws. Martin Costi, NPR News.
California officials have filed a lawsuit claiming President Trump exceeded his authority by deploying the troops. Protests against the federal immigration raids are being held in many major cities. They include New York, Dallas, Atlanta, Boston, San Francisco, Denver, Philadelphia, and Seattle. In Chicago, thousands of protesters turned out yesterday to demonstrate against the raids. Chicago police say that at one point a car drove into the crowd of protesters. It's not clear if the driver's been arrested or if anyone was hurt. President Trump has announced the U.S. Army will change back the names of 7 military bases. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the bases will again bear names associated with Confederate war figures.
At the end of the first Trump administration, a bipartisan effort changed 9 base names that honored Confederate generals over the objections of then-President Trump. In his second term, Trump already ordered 2 of those to change back, including Fort Bragg in North Carolina, named for a general considered among the worst in the Confederate Army. Trump was speaking at Fort Bragg when he announced the other 7 bases would again commemorate Confederate generals like Robert E. Lee and A.P. Hill. Hours later, the official Army announcement said something else. Fort Lee will officially be named after Private Fitz Lee, who earned a Medal of Honor in the Spanish-American War. All 9 bases will honor troops from the past 150 years who happen to share the names of Confederate figures. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
President Trump says he plans to eliminate the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He wants to turn disaster relief efforts over to the states. Trump has named a panel to come up with a replacement for FEMA by the end of this year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 180 points. This is NPR. President Trump says China will provide the U.S. with rare earth minerals. Officials from the U.S. and China have been negotiating trade issues this week in London. Writing online this morning, Trump says, quote, the deal is done. He also says the relationship between the two nations is excellent. The government says annual inflation picked up slightly in May. Consumer prices were up 2.4% last month compared to a year ago. Forecasters say President Trump's tariffs may have contributed to the rising price of some goods in May. Every year, shortly after the excitement of the Tony Awards, another kind of reality sets in on Broadway. Shows are closing that did not earn awards and are struggling at the box office. Jeff London reports that Smash, the musical based on the TV series, has announced that it is closing later this month.
Despite a rave review in the New York Times, Smash only received a pair of Tony nominations and didn't win either. With low weekly grosses, its producers announced the show would close on June 22nd after only 84 performances. Let me be your star. Two star-driven vehicles that were big hits closed on Tony weekend after limited and highly successful runs. Othello with Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal, and Good Night and Good Luck with George Clooney. The latter brought in $4.3 million last week and was seen by more than 7 million people in a live CNN broadcast this past weekend. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Martinez. A curfew was in effect here in Los Angeles last night. Mayor Karen Bass said it only covered the 1 square mile area of downtown LA where protests happened last weekend.
Law enforcement will arrest individuals who break the curfew, and you will be prosecuted.
Police arrested about 25 people on suspicion of violating the order.
That's the backdrop for a nationwide debate over immigration, protest, and the use of federal power. The curfew came after protests against immigration raids, and after President Trump took federal control of National Guard units, and after he sent in U.S. Marines. Our colleague Adrian Florido followed what was happening in L.A. during daylight hours yesterday.
All day, crowds gathered outside the downtown federal building where ICE has its offices. National Guard troops blocked the entrances, and lines of police kept protesters at a distance. There was no sign yet of the 700 Marines President Trump called into the city. Protesters waved Mexican flags. Some shouted into officers' faces. Dozens stormed onto a nearby freeway. They were arrested. But this was all contained within a couple of blocks. Across the rest of this vast city, daily life went on. And so did the immigration raids that federal officials have vowed will continue.
The details on the ground matter in the debate that follows. People threw rocks and other objects at police and burned several cars in a small part of the city. President Trump used that to describe a city on the edge of destruction. He delivered a campaign-style rally before U.S. Army troops in North Carolina.
We will not allow federal agents to be attacked, and we will not allow an American city to be invaded and conquered by a foreign enemy, and that's what they are.
The president's story changed during the day. He claimed that California's governor and the LA mayor were financing the protests. Later, he took that back while alleging somebody must be doing that.
California Governor Gavin Newsom used the details on the ground to describe a vast abuse of power. Newsom delivered a speech to the cameras that some TV networks carried live last night.
What Donald Trump wants most is your fealty, your silence, to be complicit in this moment. Do not
give in to him.
Now, the president had taken two rare steps. He took federal control of California National Guard units without the governor's approval, and he sent active duty U.S. Marines to police an American city. California sued, saying the president exceeded his power under a law that allows him to use troops against a rebellion, and also that the troops aren't needed. A judge declined to immediately block the troops from some duties, but scheduled a hearing for tomorrow. So, what is the purpose of this deployment? We called Tricia McLaughlin, who's an assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, which includes immigration enforcement. We spoke early Tuesday, LA time, so this reflects events on the ground up to then. How is the administration using the National Guard?
A lot of different ways, Steve. Crowd control, also defense of these federal buildings. We've seen these federal buildings be defaced, threatening language on them, kill ICE, kill America, death to America. So we just really need more resources on the ground. Steve, we saw on Friday about 1,000 protesters were surrounding ICE enforcement in a federal building, far outnumbering them. And then we saw that again on Sunday, about 6,000 protesters, again, vastly outnumbering our ICE enforcement officers. So this is really just greater resources and largely part for crowd control.
This is part of my question. Is there some specific capability that the Guard has that the police do not or that ICE does not?
No, I think it's more boots on the ground. It's more men and women in uniform, making sure that law enforcement's safe, our federal property's safe, and that those protesters are safe as well. Right now, we've seen out of the leadership of Governor Newsom and Karen Bass that things have not been peaceful. They have not been smooth. And so that's something we want to return law and order.
Marines have been sent into Los Angeles. It's very early, but what skills do the Marines have that apply in this particular urban situation that even the National Guard does not have?
Well, it's the same as the National Guard. These are highly trained members of our military. They have means to control crowds, especially when things get out of control with rioters. We've seen our members of law enforcement being pummeled with rocks. We've seen fires, cars being lit on fire, and like I said before, buildings and public property being defaced and otherwise assaulting ICE enforcement officers. So these are highly trained members of the military, and they have means of regaining control.
I've seen the video and the photos of the cars. That's certainly true. But I think about the role of the military and what Secretary Pete Hegseth wants the military to do. He's emphasized a focus on the mission, which he defines as lethality, and readiness, meaning readiness for combat. How does sending Marines to protect buildings and cars in Los Angeles match up with that mission, if at all?
Well, I think at the end of the day, Steve, Americans want peace, and we want peace abroad, and we want peace on our own home soil. And unfortunately, if Governor Newsom and Mayor Karen Bass are not going to call down the rioters who are assaulting our law enforcement, then we do need to bring in the military to make sure we have the resources on the ground. This country is safe and that we can restore law and order.
Okay. The president's memorandum in sending National Guard troops to California said that the protests can be construed as a kind of rebellion. That's the word that's used. I want to see how we can understand this as a rebellion. I would think of a rebellion as a group of people where they have a leader and an objective. Are you able to identify who's in charge of this rebellion?
I think that there's major questions right now, Steve, about who is financially backing these protests. There's some activity on the ground that it seems that is highly coordinated and that there might be a financial backer that could be even a foreign adversary. And we are having the IRS and the FBI look further into who might be backing these protests.
The IRS, that's interesting. Why are they involved?
Financial backing.
Got it. So you think that there might be some tax record of this or something that the Treasury Department would investigate?
Well, IRS does financial investigations as well.
Looking nationally, how many people did the United States deport last month?
Last month? I don't have that number on my hand. No, I'd have to get back to you on that. I know deportations are around in the last 125 days, about 150,000.
150,000 in 125 days. So I'm just trying to do a quick bit of math there. Yeah, so that's 30 or 40,000 a month is what you believe you're doing?
Probably roughly. I mean, I think we've been definitely able to ramp up efforts. I mean, we did inherit, you know, a very broken ICE, a very broken CBP, people who were not able to do their jobs for the last 4 years.
We're ballparking on the numbers here because we don't know the exact number for this year, but it seems that the rate of deportations is higher than the average under President Biden, but still considerably lower than the average under President Trump or President Obama. Why do you think it has been difficult to get the numbers up?
Well, we have been facing a historic number of injunctions, Steve, as you know, at the hands of a lot of these judges. We knew that coming in, though. I think it's a matter of partially of resources. We do need to pass this bill by Congress to make sure we give our ICE enforcement officers more resources, especially in the face of these kinds of protests. But further than that, these officers haven't been allowed to do their jobs for the last 4 years. So you're going from 0 to 100 very quickly because they're once again empowered to do their jobs.
The Obama administration faced the same legal constraints that you do. The first Trump administration faced the same legal constraints.
I would definitely counter that. This has been the most injunctions in American history under a single president. Absolutely, Steve.
I mean, it's the same fundamental court system. Could that have to do with what the administration has done rather than the judges suddenly changing?
No, I think, I mean, take the case of Kilmer Obrego Garcia. Take the case of the eight heinous convicted individuals who had final deportation orders out of South Sudan, those eight individuals, and the Massachusetts judge ordering that they come back. This is unprecedented. Why on earth do we have district judges who so desperately want to bring child rapists and killers who have been convicted and have final deportation orders back to U.S. soil? It is pure activism, Steve, and it's quite disturbing, really.
I guess we should note that the Supreme Court unanimously, among other courts, have insisted that people may well be terrorists, but that they should be, their cases should be heard in court. And that does lead to one more question, since you brought up Kilmer Obrego Garcia.
Yes.
You brought him back to the United States to face criminal charges. I guess he'll get his day in court, and he's facing quite an indictment. But the administration said for months that he could not be brought back. Now that the United States has brought him back, would you agree that it was always possible to bring him back?
I would leave that to the Department of Justice, but I think that what really matters here, Steve, is the egg on the face of a lot of Democrats in the media who have been hell-bent on saying that this is an innocent Maryland man. They've been saying that for months. He was a full-time human trafficker, allegedly. I have to counter what you said, Steve, because I completely disagree. I think the environment that we're in from a judicial standpoint is far, far different than anything under Obama or even under the first administration of President Trump.
I just don't understand, because it's many of the same judges. Why do you think they suddenly changed?
I don't know if it is the same judges, but I think that there's a lot of
lifetime appointments. Hundreds of them would be the same people.
I think there's a lot of politically ambitious judges, Steve.
Just to clarify, you said you'd leave it to the Department of Justice. I understand. But given that it is now clear that it was possible to bring him back, why did the government not previously bring him back?
I mean, there's, of course, you've heard the facilitate versus effectuate argument.
Sure.
Multiple times. He is now, Kilmer Obrego Garcia, before was not facing a grand jury in Tennessee, and now he is. So the facts on the ground have changed.
Tricia McLaughlin, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time and the questions.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you having me.
She's the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Now, we are following that in the past 24 hours, protests spread to several other cities. And our colleague Tom Bowman obtained a DHS memo detailing a proposal to use National Guard troops to support immigration enforcement across the country, including, quote, night operations and rural interdiction. We'll bring you more as we learn it on NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. Elon Musk is gone from Doge, but Doge is still at work. Some Doge staffers now have positions within government agencies. We'll talk with the Washington Post's Hannah Natanson, who's reported on how Doge has made the government more inefficient and bureaucratic, fired too many people, and what Doge is up to now. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Opposition to the war in Gaza has fueled a new diplomatic approach. France is leading an effort to support the formal recognition of a Palestinian state. It is a significant step that major Western countries were reluctant to take until the devastation caused by the war. But Israel is threatening to retaliate. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
To chart a path to peace, France and Saudi Arabia are gathering countries at UN headquarters in New York next week. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot explains the goal in a video statement.
Recréer une dynamique diplomatique pour établir un État palestinien viable.
To restore diplomatic momentum for establishing a viable Palestinian state and guaranteeing the security of Israel and the region. That may sound like the same old failed script of Middle East peacemaking, but France is trying to flip the script. Ofer Bronstein, the French president's advisor on Israeli-Palestinian relations, says talking peace has not gone anywhere for decades.
Not only we didn't move forward, but we are moving backward. We are proposing, first of all, recognition and then negotiation, and not the opposite.
That's why France wants Palestine recognized before pursuing talks for a final resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That recognition, he says, would give Palestinians equal status to Israel, with two states negotiating peace. Next week at the conference, he expects Belgium, Luxembourg, Malta, Croatia, and Greece to recognize Palestine right away. The big diplomatic question is, when will France and other major countries join? The French president's advisor, Bronstein.
France will recognize the state of Palestine with other countries very soon.
Very soon. He expects France, the UK, Canada, and other economic powerhouses like Japan to hold off on recognizing a state of Palestine until the Gaza war ends. Those countries seek other commitments too, like reforming Palestinian leadership, disarming Hamas, and convincing some Muslim and Arab countries like Indonesia and Syria to recognize Israel. This whole diplomatic initiative angers the Israeli government. Deputy Foreign Minister Sharon Haskel says after the deadliest attack in Israeli history, all this does is reward Hamas.
Because they think that the 7th of October attack was actually successful enough that the international community will actually recognize a Palestinian state. So it's actually contradicting our efforts and the American efforts towards a ceasefire as well.
She says Israel could take action if countries follow through on this.
Unilateral actions may lead to unilateral action on our part as well.
That could include Israel annexing parts of the occupied West Bank that Palestinians want included in their state, according to an Israeli official who spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity and didn't have permission to speak about this publicly. Despite that official stance, there are Israeli peace activists supporting the French push to recognize Palestinian statehood, including Alon Liel. He was the Israeli ambassador to South Africa in the waning years of apartheid and saw the world come together to stop it. He hopes this diplomatic initiative can stop Israel's offensive in Gaza, the deadliest Palestinians have ever faced.
If today, 2025, the world cannot stop this kind of atrocities from happening. We have a new world order. Every country can do whatever it wants.
More than three-quarters of UN countries already recognize Palestine. During the Gaza war, 9 countries joined that list, including Spain, Norway, and Ireland. The U.S. is not one of them and won't participate in the peace conference. Still, the Palestinian Authority is lobbying countries to send their top leaders to next week's UN conference, says Palestinian diplomat Omar Awadallah.
We believe that this is the beginning of a big momentum. It is the shift or a historic turning point to the goal of implementing the two-state solution.
But that two-state solution is no longer endorsed by Israel's current hard-right government. And many in the Palestinian public think a Palestinian state is no longer realistic, given Israel's accelerated building of Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Next week's conference will test whether countries can bring the two-state solution back from the dead. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Department of Homeland Security says an immigration raid at a meatpacking plant in Omaha is its largest workplace enforcement action since President Trump's second inauguration. Here's Nebraska Public Media's Molly Ashford.
It was a tense scene yesterday outside of Glen Valley Foods. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents loaded at least 75 people into a large white bus with boarded up windows. They say the people were working at the meatpacking plant without authorization. The raid came as a surprise to community members like Diane Sutko. She and others learned about the raid and a later protest on Facebook.
We should have been expecting it, but still it was a shock.
Rumors swirled online about additional raids at meatpacking plants and construction sites in Omaha, but Homeland Security says the raid at Glen Valley was the only ICE operation in the city yesterday. Glen Valley is one of the city's smaller meatpacking plants. The company did not return calls for comment. Still, even one raid put Omaha's immigrant population and their friends on edge.
I'm friends with 3 families from Venezuela, and they've done everything right. They've got work permits, and they've all got jobs, and they're all wonderful people, and I'm so fearful for them.
Along a busy street in the city's meatpacking district, cars honked as hundreds gathered to show support for immigrants. Dayanara Lopez Cruz described Omaha's Latino community as tight-knit, where everybody knows everybody. She said she showed up to protest because she saw what her parents sacrificed.
My parents are from different countries. They fought for my life. My dad has had issues with ICE, and my mom has been fighting for residency ever since I could remember.
Homeland Security said in a statement that the raid was the result of a criminal investigation into what they said was the large-scale employment of undocumented workers. It still isn't clear where the detainees were taken. Local advocates say they are working to provide legal aid to the people arrested and to provide support to their families. For NPR News, I'm Molly Ashford in Omaha, Nebraska.
This is NPR News.
As disasters get more intense, home insurance is getting more expensive, and many homeowners are retrofitting their houses, like strengthening their roofs, to reduce their risk and insurance premiums.
That's a big incentive. I mean, homeowners insurance now has been through the roof because of the storms we've had through here.
How some states are trying to help homeowners on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Protests against federal immigration raids and detentions without due process have been staged across the United States. Many are peaceful. In Los Angeles, peaceful gatherings, unrest, and arrests continued in the wake of the U.S. military's presence. Critics accuse President Trump of manufacturing a security breakdown. Attorney General Pam Bondi refutes the allegation.
All of our police officers, all of our federal, state, local law enforcement officers being abused out there trying to keep California safe. Jointly, we've all made over 190 arrests, more coming. If you hit a police officer, you assault a police officer, state or federal, we are coming after you.
Bondi on Fox. An appeal hearing for President Trump's criminal conviction and sentencing is set to take place in a federal court of appeals in Manhattan today. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
Today's hearing is in front of a three-judge panel, and they'll have to confer, so there won't be a decision today. But what we'll really be listening for is what questions the judges ask, if they're skeptical or not, what they're skeptical about. This hearing and the decision will have implications beyond just Trump's case. If the judges rule in Trump's favor, it could ultimately make it easier to work around the state courts in our judicial system.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting. From Washington, this is NPR News. During hurricanes and wildfires, people in harm's way receive evacuation alerts through their mobile providers. And the Federal Communications Commission planned to update those alerts to include multiple languages. But as NPR's Nate Perez explains, that has not happened.
The FCC was supposed to begin updating its emergency alert system in multiple languages in January. But it has yet to do that. The update included the 13 most commonly spoken languages in the U.S., such as Korean and Arabic. Around 12,000 Asian Americans needed language assistance during the L.A. wildfires earlier this year. UCLA professor Paul Ong says having multilingual emergency alerts could have helped.
Among Asian Americans, we find literally dozens of languages spoken. And that speaks to the cultural diversity of this population.
The FCC and the White House did not respond to multiple emails from NPR requesting comment. Nate Perez, NPR News.
The South Korean military stopped loudspeaker broadcasts into North Korea. The latest decision is part of the South's new president's attempts to break decades of on-again, off-again psychological warfare with its northern rival. While the South has stopped the cross-border blaring, residents say the North has not. The Dow is up 158 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Downtown Los Angeles was under curfew last night for the first time since anti-ICE protests began on Friday.
City officials said the protests have been largely peaceful, but instances of vandalism and looting led them to implement the curfew. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has moved ahead with the deployment of Marines and more National Guard over the objections of state and city leaders.
Joining us now to talk about the military's role in Los Angeles is NPR's Martin Costi. So, Martin, the National Guard arrived over the weekend. Marines are now in the city, though we don't yet know where they'll be. Is it clear what their mission is?
Well, the administration says they're there to protect federal facilities and employees, and we've seen some of that. The row of National Guard with shields standing there as a human barrier in front of federal buildings. There have also been reports, though, of the Guard protecting ICE agents out in the field as they do their jobs, and that could put some of those soldiers into more dynamic situations that might start to look a little bit like they're part of enforcement.
Okay, would they be allowed to do that to assist ICE directly with its enforcement work?
The experts say no because of a 19th century law known as posse comitatus, which bars the military from acting as police inside the country. I asked William Banks about this. He's a professor at Syracuse University, and he's been studying this very question about what's legal for the military inside the country for years.
For sure, they can't arrest if the crowds are trying to push through them or throwing rocks at their face or something like that. They could protect themselves. That's federal protection, but they can't enforce the law.
Okay, so he says the military isn't supposed to do law enforcement, but they have been deployed inside the country over the years. I mean, I remember back in 1992, right here in Los Angeles, where I'm at, during the Rodney King riots. I mean, how is this military deployment different?
Legally, the difference is that in 92, President George H.W. Bush invoked the Insurrection Act, which allows for the use of the active military to quell civil disturbances. But maybe just as important here is the difference that this time around, the state and local authorities don't want the military's help, and they don't know what to expect from the military now that they're here. And you can hear that frustration in the voice of L.A. Mayor Karen Bass. This is her last night when someone asked her, "What are the Marines doing?"
Who knows? I mean, the bottom line is that we're not told. Basically, we have to operate on rumors.
And, you know, this is really unusual. Normally, you'd have the military plugged into the local emergency management system, coordinating with the police.
So what happens then if, say, the National Guard and or the Marines get into a situation that requires force? I mean, how prepared is the military to use force against American civilians?
The National Guard get crowd control training, and they have some of the gear, such as those shields. As to the Marines, well, I talked to Mick Wagoner. He's a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel who focused on military law. And he said there are some Marines who get specialized training for missions such as evacuating U.S. embassies that are threatened by crowds. But he said that's just not the same as police work. And he recalled an infamous case during the 92 riots in L.A. when the police asked some Marines to cover them as they approached a house.
And the Marines then lay down suppressing fire. The police were completely aghast. "What are you doing?" And you said to cover you. It's like, "Yeah, tell us if somebody sticks their head out or if you see a gun or something. But Jesus, you just lit up that house."
Wagoner says that case shows just how differently the police and military approach things and even understand basic words like "cover me." And he says he really hopes that these Marines in LA now will be kept in the rear behind the National Guard, because at least some of them may be police officers in their day jobs and may have more training for crowds.
All right, that's NPR's Martin Costi. Thanks a lot, Martin.
You're welcome.
Immunologist Dennis Burton got some bad news recently. On the last Friday in May, he learned that the Trump administration was going to end a project he'd co-led for nearly 15 years. Its purpose was to develop a vaccine against AIDS.
It's devastating. It's very, very dispiriting. So much effort, so much human toil has gone into this, and now that's just going to be thrown away just when we look like we could beat this virus.
NPR's Jonathan Lambert picks up the story.
It wasn't just Dennis Burton who was devastated. Many researchers in the field believed they were getting closer than ever to developing a vaccine against AIDS after nearly 40 years of trying. Burton was part of a $258 million project called the Center for HIV/AIDS Vaccine Development that's been at the cutting edge of trying to solve a really difficult problem. Here's Burton again.
It's one of the most difficult problems there is in biomedicine. One of the most formidable things about HIV is that it's not just one virus. It's hundreds of thousands of different strains of virus.
That makes HIV really good at dodging the immune system's first responders, antibodies. Burton and his colleagues at Scripps Research Institute, along with Duke University, were working on ways of coaxing the immune system to make what are called broadly neutralizing antibodies.
They're able to recognize different strains, and they're very potent.
Animal studies suggest this strategy could work, and human trials were slated to start next year. But now, those trials likely won't happen. Here's Mark Feinberg, CEO of IAVI, a nonprofit that develops vaccines.
It's really disappointing at this time, which is really more promising in the HIV vaccine effort than ever before, to have the foundation kicked out from underneath you.
In a statement to NPR, a spokesperson for HHS says that they're trying to end what they call wasteful and inefficient spending. The Trump administration's cuts go far beyond just one project. Linda Gale Becker is with the University of Cape Town. She was part of a big USAID-funded project to develop and test HIV vaccine candidates in Africa, including ones developed by Burton's Grant. Just days before her team was set to start clinical trials, they got a stop work order from the U.S. government.
So ill-timed and such a tragedy. It felt like the stars were beginning to align for the field again after, you know, sort of going through the valley of despair of not having success.
She and her colleagues are scrambling to find other sources of funding. But the U.S. will be tough to replace. In 2022, it accounted for nearly 90% of total HIV vaccine research spending worldwide. In a climate of widespread grant cancellations and talk of over 40% cuts to research funding next year, many scientists fear recent advances will stall out.
We need all our energy to win the scientific war, and now we have to fight this turning away from the science, a real disregard for the need for an HIV vaccine.
While effective treatments do exist for HIV, Becker says that only a vaccine can ultimately end the pandemic. She believes the field will eventually get back on track, but that will take time. Time, she says, that will cost many lives that might have been saved by a vaccine. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
This is NPR News. President Trump says families will be better off if his budget bill passes. But at a food bank in rural Virginia, an organizer tells a different story. Next time in Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. In 2021, K-pop group BTS had 4 top 10 songs in the U.S., 5 Grammy nominations, and the ARMY, their millions of fans. But a year later, BTS said it would BRB so that its members could join South Korea's actual ARMY. 2 members were discharged yesterday. All 7 are expected to finish their mandatory service later this month. To celebrate, their agency posted a sign saying, "We are back." It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Mae Martinez. Like other states where abortion is legal, Maryland has seen more people coming for care from out of state. Many need financial assistance. As WYPR's Scott Massioni reports, Maryland is the first state to tap money associated with Obamacare to help them.
The Baltimore Abortion Fund has seen so much demand that it had to change how it allocates funds. Lynn McCann-Yeh is a co-director.
We were receiving so many calls in the first half of the month that by the time we were, you know, a week or 2 weeks in, we had exhausted all available financial support and had to actually close down our helpline.
McCann-Yeh estimates the fund turns away around a third of the people who call. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022, Maryland clinics have been providing about 39,000 abortions a year, up from 31,000 in 2020. Part of the reason is that Maryland voters put reproductive rights in the state constitution. The new laws encourage more clinicians to offer abortion. Dr. Diane Horvath is with Partners in Abortion Care, a Maryland clinic that specializes in later abortions after 13 weeks, which are expensive. She says up to 80% of her late-term patients are from out of state, and almost all of them need financial support.
I would say a typical patient is somebody who's already got children, at least one child. They're working a job that doesn't offer substantial leave for medical care. It may not offer health insurance, or the insurance it offers doesn't cover abortion, and they're struggling and living paycheck to paycheck.
Now, Maryland is turning to a pot of money that many forgot existed. When Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, it had to deal with the Hyde Amendment. That law forbids the use of federal funds, like Medicaid, to pay for most abortions. But some states wanted insurance plans sold on the new marketplaces to cover abortion. So they used a provision in the Affordable Care Act to levy a small surcharge, usually just a dollar, on each insurance plan sold through the new marketplaces. The surcharges go into a pot, and that fund covers the cost if an insured patient needs abortion care. But in many states, the funds have built up a surplus over the last 15 years. In Maryland, it's now $25 million. Now, a new state law will tap into those funds to give grants to groups like the Baltimore Abortion Fund. Horvath says her clinic will be able to do more.
Our ability to see people and to care for them is directly related to the well-being of the abortion funds that help get patients to us. So we're delighted about this.
The money can now be used for patients traveling from other states and for those with no insurance. Maryland Delegate Leslie Lopez, a Democrat, helped sponsor the bill.
We're making sure our clinics stay open, and we're the only southern state that has this constitutionally protected right, and so you have folks coming from other places.
However, some Marylanders feel the law forces residents to pay for abortions they may disagree with. Laura Bogley's the executive director of Maryland Right to Life and testified against the bill in the state legislature.
This bill uses insurance premiums from insured women to abort the children of uninsured women. Many of those uninsured women are non-Maryland residents.
The law goes into effect this summer. Supporters hope it will become a model for other states that still allow abortion. Again, Delegate Leslie Lopez.
We're looking for California, Illinois, New York, those bigger states that are sitting on potentially hundreds of millions of dollars to take what we've done here in Maryland and implement it there.
For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WYPR and KFF Health News. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The cost of home insurance is skyrocketing. In some states like Utah and Arizona, premiums have jumped more than 40%. That's important because insurance is something most homeowners have to buy to qualify for a mortgage. Michael Copley is here to talk about insurance as part of NPR's Climate Solutions Week, this year focusing on the ways climate change affects where and how we live. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So I mentioned the extreme cases. Can you give me a big picture sense of what home insurance costs are looking like?
Prices are pretty much across the board across the country. So the Consumer Federation of America says premiums on average have increased 24% nationwide in the past few years. And in some places, insurers are dropping customers. It's caught the attention of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Here's Powell at a congressional hearing this winter.
If you fast forward 10 or 15 years, there are going to be regions of the country where you can't get a mortgage.
If people can't get mortgages, they can't buy houses, right? And that can depress property values, which can reduce property taxes that local governments rely on to fund public services like police and firefighters.
Wow, that's a pretty ominous chain reaction you're talking about there. Why is this happening?
The cost of disasters keeps rising, and that's hitting insurers' bottom line. So climate change is causing more extreme weather that damages and destroys property. People keep moving to risky places like coastal regions vulnerable to hurricanes, rural areas prone to wildfires. And then when disasters happen, inflation is making it a lot more expensive to rebuild.
So as the cost of disasters has been going up, insurers then are passing some of the costs on to homeowners.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Insurers say they need to raise prices to reflect the threats that they face. And in some markets, they're pulling back, dropping customers to avoid huge losses.
So if the problem is the cost of disasters, what's the solution?
One big one is that homeowners and communities can better protect themselves. Hardening homes is something we hear a lot about. That means, you know, installing fortified roofs to withstand hurricanes, using fire-resistant building material, removing vegetation from around homes, thinning forests to sort of protect properties from wildfires. Some of that's happening. But when insurers are deciding to write or renew coverage, they're rarely considering what's been done to protect a property to make it more resilient. That's according to Dave Jones, who runs the Climate Risk Initiative at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley Law.
So if those kinds of investments could reduce the risks insurers face, why aren't companies accounting for them?
One reason I heard is the cost and effort of assessing what's been done. And to be clear, there are some grants that are available to help homeowners pay for things like fortified roofs. And homeowners in some states can get insurance discounts if they make investments to protect their property. But the discounts are relatively small. And Jones says there's still this fundamental problem.
If they won't write you the insurance because they're not taking into account forest treatment and they're not taking into account home hardening, the discount doesn't help you.
Jones recently helped a community in California get insurance based on the work that it had done to protect itself against wildfire. And what he's trying to do now is get other insurers to do similar things.
And so what are the insurers telling you?
Yeah, so I talked to a trade group and what they said was, you know, insurers are not ignoring these kinds of investments. The problem is that they have essentially been regrouping after costs shot up. And so they've had to limit how much coverage they offer in certain markets. And that these insurers will almost certainly look at what communities and homeowners have done to protect property when they're in a position to grow their business again in some of these markets.
But the risks are going to keep growing because of climate change, aren't they?
That's exactly right. It's not a static picture. So what I'm hearing is a lot more talk about really rethinking where and how we live. So that means overhauling building codes and land use policies and ultimately cutting climate pollution that's raising global temperatures.
That is Michael Copley from NPR's Climate Desk. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, how people in places devastated by hurricanes are rebuilding with the next flood in mind. You can find more stories from our series at npr.org/climateweek. Michael, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
Okay, so you probably heard about that classic folktale, Stone Soup. Travelers claim they can make soup out of a stone and trick villagers into sharing their food. It turns out pretty good. Well, now there's perpetual stew, and it's for real. It's when you keep a stew, well, stewing for days, weeks, maybe even years. When you serve some out, you keep replenishing the broth and its ingredients. And somehow, say the people who have tried it, it actually stays tasty.
Very spicy and delicious and nutritious.
It's pretty much the same as yesterday, but less oily. So I'm happy with the addition of our starchy ingredients.
It's more flavorful than any soup or stew I've ever had.
TikTok users Aubrey Ash, Zachary Levitt, and Alex Thompson all give names to their perpetual stews.
Supina got a little low on fluids.
Stuthius
is named Stoopies.
Stoopies! Perpetual stew went viral a couple of years ago when Annie Rowarda started serving one out of a slow cooker in Brooklyn. She runs the Depths of Wikipedia social media pages, and her stew is still making the rounds online.
But is it safe?
Unless you maintain the stew at a safe temperature, which is about over 140 degrees Fahrenheit, you can get bacterial growth in that stew.
James Rogers is the director of product safety research and testing at Consumer Reports.
You should be using a food thermometer to measure what the temperature is, and you must keep it at all times above 140 degrees Fahrenheit, even overnight.
Rogers doesn't recommend you try this at home, but if you do,
you might want to consider when you're adding new ingredients, especially vegetables, that you clean them well and that you may pre-cook them before you add them, because they could be a source of new bacteria that you'll be introducing into the stew.
And if your stew dips below that 140 degrees, Rogers recommends you throw it all out.
Because sometimes some bacteria will release toxins when they grow, and these toxins are resistant to heat. So when you reheat the food, the bacteria may die, but the toxins may still be there.
Alex Thompson, who lives in Arizona, took the risk.
I started doing the perpetual stew because it helps have a meal ready every night with very little dishes, since it stays in the same pot.
So are you going to try it?
Stew betcha. Why not? I got nothing to lose at this point, Michelle. I made it to half a century old, so why not at this point?
That's a no.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle.
I'll just quiet.